like this, how many dead dreamers you want with my name on them. Now it was light enough that he had come into view beside her, his silhouette climbing, face pensive. He was a peculiar-looking person, she thought. Most people could be put into this pile or another. So-and-so reminds me of what's-her-face, one says. This dude is this sort of person. Oh, they're that kind of a person. But what was Bride? Bride. Party of one. If he reminded her of anything, he reminded her of... The resemblance slipped away. Bride said, get better then. Get better, he says. Bread and jam, easy. You're a real ass. Did you know? When have you ever failed at anything? You've been at this for weeks, he said. Do you know how old I am? There was something a little dangerous about the question. Hennessy couldn't tell if it was dangerous to answer it correctly or dangerous to answer it incorrectly, though. Eventually she said, older than Ronan thinks. Yes, Bride said. Now it was possible to see they were headed toward a great hollow stump, a tree that must have been enormous when it was alive. But then Hennessy remembered it was alive. It was the tree from West Virginia, transplanted. Illidorn.
Yes,
Bride said again, and he sounded tired.
Older than he imagines.
The tree grew from bare, dark rock on a precipice that jutted high above a vast and glittering pink, orange, yellow-blue ocean. The sea below looked cold and ancient, the barely audible waves breaking slow and sure. Everything was still black where the sun had not yet reached. It was beautiful, and Hennessy hated it. She hated it, or she hated herself. That one.
Self-hatred is an expensive hobby paid for by other people, Bride said.
Look,
here he is.
Ronan was in the tree, or rather, a Ronan was inside the tree. The Ronan inside the tree was dressed in black, curled inside the hollow. His arms crossed over each other, his posture undeniably the same as Ronan in the real world. But this Ronan was old. Well, older. Grizzled. This Ronan had walked and walked through this world. His cheeks were hard and chiseled beneath scrubby shadow. Deep crow lines formed around his eyes from decades of laughing and frowning into the sun. His shaved head had grown out just enough to show that his temples were gray, same as the hair that shadowed his jaw. There was one thick trail of night wash that oozed from one of his closed eyes, but two tiny mice, the size of walnuts, were furiously working away at it with their paws and their tongues. Old, older than he imagines. Hennessy wanted to say something to cut the moment, but she couldn't. She was so angry, so tangled in the grips of this wild ocean, this distant sunrise, this lightning peak, this wearied Ronan from another time curled in an ancient tree. Why did it have to be this way? She kept thinking. Why did she have to be this way? She longed for the Hennessy in the car, the one who thought she didn't care about anything. What a splendid liar she was. She cared about everything. After the mice were done, they scurried away into the darkness of the hollow of the tree, leaving Ronan motionless in the protective curve of the stump. Come back, Ronan, Bride said softly. The night wash will not have you this time. Silence. Just the barely heard sound of that slow, old ocean down below. Ronan Lynch, Hennessy said. Ronan's eyes opened. They were his eyes, after all, bright blue and intense. He looked at them both, this young, old Ronan.
more playing, he said. He sounded tired. We save the ley lines.
16. Declan had been told a long time ago that he had to know what he wanted or he'd never get it. Not by his father, because his father would have never delivered such pragmatic advice in such a pragmatic way. No, even if Neil Lynch believed in the sentiment, he would have wrapped it up in a long story filled with metaphor and magic and nonsense riddles. Only years after the storytelling would Declan be sitting somewhere and realize that all along Neil had been trying to teach him to balance his checkbook or whatever the tale had ever really been about. Neil could never just say the thing. No, this piece of advice, you have to know what you want or you'll never get it, was given to Declan by a senator from Nevada he'd met during a D.C. field trip back in eighth grade. The other children had been bored by the pale stone restraint of the city and the sameness of the law and government offices they toured. Declan, however, had been fascinated. He'd asked the senator what advice he had for those looking to get into politics. Come from money, the senator had said first, and then when all the eighth graders and their teachers had stared without laughing, he added, you have to know what you want, or you'll never get it. Make goals. Declan made goals. The goal was D.C. The goal was politics. The goal was structure, and more structure, and yet more structure. He took AP classes on political science and policy. When he traveled with his father to black markets, he wrote papers. When he took calls from gangsters and shady antique auction houses, he arranged drop-offs near D.C. and wrangled meetings with HR people. Aglenby Academy made calls and pulled strings. He got names, numbers, internships. All was going according to plan. His father inconveniently got murdered, but Declan pressed on. His father's will conveniently left him a townhouse adjacent to D.C. Declan pressed on. He kept his brothers alive. He graduated. He moved to D.C. He made the goal. He went toward the goal. When he took his first lunch meeting with his new boss, he found himself filled with the same anticipation he'd had as an eighth grader. This was the place, he thought, where things happened. Just across the road was the Mexican embassy. Behind him was the IMF. GW Law School was a block away. The White House, the USPS, the Red Cross, all within a stone's throw. This was before he understood that there was no making it. For him. He came from money, yeah, but the wrong kind of money. Neil Lynch's clout was not relevant in this daylight world. He only had status in the night, and one could not rise above that while remaining invisible to protect one's dangerous brother. On that first day of work, Declan walked into the Renwick Gallery and stood inside an installation that had taken over the second floor around the grand staircase. Tens of thousands of black threads had been installed at points all along the ceiling, tangling around the Villarreal LED sculpture that normally lit the room, snarling the railing over the stairs, blocking out the light from the tall arches that bordered the walls, turning the walkways into dark, confusing rabbit tunnels. Museum-goers had to pick their way through with caution, lest they be snared and bring the entire world down with them. He had, bizarrely, felt tears burning the corners of his eyes. Before that, he hadn't understood that his goals and what he wanted might not be the same thing. This was where he'd found art. Declan stood in the small Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston, looking at John Singer Sargent's El Jaleo. The dim room, the so-called Spanish cloister, was long and skinny. The walls were colorful with complicated Mexican tiles and lined with stone fountains and basins. El Jaleo was the only painting in the room, hung in a shallow alcove framed by a Moorish arch. Antique pots rested around its base,
tricking the viewer into believing themselves part of the scene in the painting. A cunning mirror stole light from the hall and threw it subtly on the canvas. Gardner had renovated this room especially for El Jaleo, and every part of it was an extension of the painting's mood. The larger a piece of art was, the farther away one was generally meant to stand from it, so Declan was not directly in front of the canvas, but rather standing 4 yards off. He was just looking at it. He had been looking at it for 10 minutes. He would probably look at it for another 10 minutes. A tear prickled his eye. A man in Florence once had a heart attack when he saw the birth of Venus, if you can believe it, said a voice beside him. Palpitations are more common there. That's what Stendhal had. Couldn't walk, he reported, after seeing a particularly moving work of art. And Jung decided it was too dangerous to visit Pompeii in his old age because the feeling of all that art and history around him, it might kill him. Jerusalem? Tourists in Jerusalem sometimes wrap themselves in hotel bedsheets to become works of art themselves, you know? Part of history, a collective unconscious toga party. One lady in the holy city decided she was giving birth to God's son. She wasn't even pregnant, before you ask. Funny what art will do to you. Stendhal syndrome, they call it. After our lad with the palpitations, though, I prefer its more modern name. Declan Lynch. Hello, Jordan, Declan said. He stood there for a space with Jordan Hennessy, both of them looking at the painting. El Jaleo was both dark and luminous. In it, a Spanish dancer twisted through a dark room. Behind her, guitarists twisted round their instruments, and onlookers clapped her arm. It was all black and brown, except for the striking white of the dancer and the flushed red in details. In person, it was obvious how much rigor had been put into the contorted dancer and how little had been devoted to the musicians in the background, forcing the viewer's attention onto her, only her. The entire work looked effortless if one didn't know better. Declan knew better. You're my prospective punter, aren't you? Jordan asked. I should have known. Mr. Potsey of South Boston. Declan said, how do you find a forger? Be in the market for a forgery. Potsey's on the nose, don't you think? Samuel Jean Potsey was the subject of one of John Singer Sargent's most dramatic portraits, a full-length glory featuring his friend Dr. Potsey, a well-known dandy in OBGYN, in a blazing red dressing gown. Declan had feared using it as a name when contacting Jordan for a forgery might give the game away, but the potential reward of looking clever was too great a temptation. You didn't guess it, did you? Declan lifted his red scarf from his collar. I'm wearing the scarf in his honor. Cadmium red, Jordan said. Slightly toxic, but little risk if handled well. Before I forget, she handed him the keys to his stolen car. Did you remember it takes premium? Crumbs, I knew I forgot something. I did top up the wiper fluid. Where is it? A lady never tells, she grinned at him. Then she stepped as close to the painting as she was permitted, bending at the waist to study the brushstrokes, graceful as one of Degas' dancers. Her grin tugged wider as she guessed correctly that he was looking at her. Straightening, she lifted her arm and twisted her body, pulling herself into a perfect imitation of El Jaleo's dancer. There was nothing like the sound of a museum, and the gardener was no exception. The murmur of other patrons in the adjacent courtyard, the sound of footsteps echoing in hallways, the respectful whispers. Jordan Hennessy was art in front of art, in a room that was art, in a building that was art, in a life that was art. And Declan told himself he had only come here to get his car back. Foolish, Declan smirked. Paranoid, Declan sneered. Paranoid Declan lost. Foolish Declan said in an even tone, "You never finished my portrait. Seems unprofessional to just leave a client hanging like that." Jordan nodded. "And now you want a refund." "A refund won't fill that hole on my wall. It'd take multiple sittings. It might be ugly along the way before it's all said and done. I trust your expertise." She tapped her fingers together absently. She didn't look at him. "You know, at the end of the day, it's still a portrait, right? Just a copy of your face. No matter how well it turns out, that's never changing. Just a copy." Declan said, "I'm perfecting my understanding of art more every day." Jordan frowned then, or at least she stopped smiling, which for her was as good as a frown. "What would you say if I told you I'd found a way to keep dreams awake?" "I would wait for the punchline." "What if I told you this painting would keep Matthew awake if something happened to Ronan? That it had dream energy in it?" Declan didn't answer right away, because a trio of women entered the room along with a docent. The four of them took an agonizing amount of time looking at the painting and taking photos in front of it and then asking the docent questions about the landscaping before they all trooped into the next room. He glanced to be sure they were out of earshot, then glanced to see that Matthew was still sitting on the bench in the courtyard looking at the flowers. Finally, he said, "I don't think I'd say anything. I'd listen." And he did, quietly, as she pressed one of her hands into his shoulder to lean close and whisper everything she'd learned about the sweet metals into his ear. She whispered how she'd realized that they were all art, and she whispered that perhaps this was why she felt so at home in museums. She whispered that this might be why she had been so drawn to John Singer Sargent in particular, and she whispered that she had decided to go to the most famous sergeant in Boston to see if it was a sweet metal. "And it is," Declan said. They looked at the painting in question. Neither said anything for a space. They just listened to the sound of both of them breathing and looking at the painting. Jordan asked, "If you were me, what would you do next?" He whispered, "Steal it." She laughed with delight, and he memorized the sound. "It's a shame you have mixed feelings about crime, Potsy," Jordan said, "because I'm pretty sure you were made for it. But don't you think the gardener's been looted enough?" "So what are you going to do?"
I think I'm gonna find out how they were made," Jordan said. "And if I can, I'm gonna try to make one."
She looked at him. He looked at her. Declan could feel all his previous goals wandering even further away from him, all of them seeming silly and arbitrary now. The childhood dreams of a kid looking for stability, wishing upon a star that later turned out to be a satellite.
"Say you'll stay in Boston," she said. "You have to know what you want, or you'll never get it."
"I'll stay in Boston," he said. 17. Ronan thought, "This is what I was made for, probably." The three dreamers sat shoulder to shoulder looking down at the Pennsylvanian landscape below, the wind buffeting them hard. Mountain ridges and valleys looked like fingers had pinched the landscape in places and thumbprinted it in others. A broad river moved northwest to southeast. A smaller river came in from west to east, curled back on itself in rippling serpentine that reminded him of the black snake they'd found at the museum. Farms were cut into rectangles that butted up against wild, dark forests. Roads were fine white hairs across it all, like parasitic worms in a dish. From this height, humans were invisible.
"What do you feel?" Bride asked.
"Free? Trapped? Alive? Guilty? Powerful? Powerless?" Ronan felt everything but the ley line. Hennessy sighed.
Bride said. Saving the ley lines is about seeing the pattern. It's hard to see the pattern when you're in it, but humans do the same things again and again. They are not that complicated. In a pair, they are individuals. Unique. Unlike. If you have half a dozen, two or three will remind you of each other. By the time you have 100, 200, you see types repeated again and again. Place two types together, they react a certain way. Place them with a different type, they react a different but equally predictable way. Humans form into groups along the same lines again and again. They fracture into smaller groups along other predictable lines again and again. 150, Dunbar's number. That is how many connections humans can support before things begin to fall apart and remake. Again, again, humans dance as elegantly as clockwork stars move across the sky, but they do not see it because they are the stars. They were very far up, thousands of meters, feet dangling, pressed together on the dreamt hoverboard, cheeks burning with cold, lungs burning with the thinness of the air. The wind moved them this way and that. They were only in danger of falling if they completely resisted the flow. They were not in a dream, but it felt like a dream. And for the first time, Ronan felt a little like he understood how Bride could say they were not two of him. Bride continued, "The non-human world has patterns, too. Look at the veins of a leaf, your hand, a tree, gold through rock, a river headed to sea, lightning. And again, again, not just in the visible, but also the invisible. In airflow, particles, sound waves, ley lines too, veining across this poor battered home of ours. Again, 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 everything predicts everything else. Everything affects everything else." Ronan felt Hennessy shiver. He leaned his skull against her skull, and without pause or snark, she leaned back. "It doesn't take much to disrupt the pattern. Look at that river there. Over the years, silt has built up along its banks, which slows it. And as it slows, it becomes less able to move the silt, so it slows further. So there is even more silt, and so it slows even more. As it slows, the river twists harder away from the obstacle, looking for the path of least resistance. Twist, slow. Twist, slow, until the curves are so tight that it becomes just a bent lake here, and then a small pond there, and then finally the water is driven below ground. This, too, is what happens to the ley lines." Ronan could almost imagine it, the glowing energy of the ley line glistening across the landscape below, pulsing beneath the mountains, seeping into the rivers. Everything had felt obvious and connected in his last dream when he was curled inside Illidorin, and some of that connectivity lingered. "Slowly the ley lines get shut down one by one by electricity and roads and trash and noise and noise and noise and noise." Bride sucked in a deep breath. "Which is why we dreamers are forced to go from vein to vein as they collapse behind us."
"So, dreamers... just a parasite," Hennessy said. "We're nothing without them."
"Is your brain a parasite?" Bride asked.
"Yes," she said immediately.
"Your lungs, your kidneys, your hands. Your heart pumps blood through your entire body. Take away the blood and things begin to fail. Does that make the brain lesser than the blood? The left hand a servant to the veins that power it? We need the ley line. The ley line needs us. The world needs us. Eventually, if we all die, and we are dying, some more quickly than others, so the rest will go. Our passing, a symptom of a bigger disease."
"And if we fix the ley lines," Ronan asked, "the disease goes away?"
Bride didn't answer right away.
He let the wind buffet him. That was the way to keep from being knocked off the board, to bend, not break. Then he said,
"A healthy body can withstand illness, can live alongside it. A world full of lay energy doesn't support dreamers and dreams only along the lines any more than a healthy body is only vital directly along the veins. It is vital from head to toe. Brain and lungs, kidney and hands, fix the ley lines, and dreamers and dreams simply exist wherever they like.
A world where Matthew could just live. A world where Ronan could just dream. A world where every dream was clear and crisp and easy to navigate so there were never accidents or nightmares. He wanted it. It had been so long since he'd wanted something to happen instead of wanting something to not happen. He'd forgotten what it felt like. It was equal parts great and terrible. It burned.
Restoring the ley lines is a game of dominoes, Bride said. If we addressed each domino separately, we would never be done. Dominoes would be set back up as soon as we turned our backs, and we'd be stopped before we were anywhere close to done. But instead, we focus only on the dominoes that will knock over many others.
Cool metaphor, Ronan said. What are the dominoes?
You already know, Bride said dismissively. All the obstacles blocking lay energy. Human noise.
And what is knocking them over, Hennessy said. Please tell me it's blowing shit up.
Sometimes, Bride admitted. Often. Hennessy made a contented noise.
Do other people get hurt? Ronan asked. Bride hesitated for only a second.
Not if we are creating nuanced solutions instead of hammering our way through.
We're dreamers. We can step lightly. What's the first domino? Ronan asked.
That's not the right question, Bride said. Always ask, what do we do last? And then you work toward that. The man who thinks step by step sees only his feet. Eyes up. What do we want?
Save the ley lines.
Step back from that, Bride said. What's one step back from that?
Ronan thought. Save Illidoran's ley line.
One step back from that?
Ronan was once again curled in Illidoran, connected to everything. A thrill chilled him as he said, "The dam."
Yes, Bride said, but there are steps between us and that still, too. There's no point moving the dam without freeing up the tributaries first. Why throw the switch with no lamps plugged in?
First, we have to remove obstacles from farther down the line and adjacent lines. Illidoran's line will be the first and the hardest, but it is a fine domino. It will knock over many others after for us. Hennessy, you're quiet.
A thin gray cloud passed between them and the world below. The patchwork fields disappeared and reappeared.
You don't bloody need me, she said.
Don't tell me what I need, Bride said.
I couldn't do anything back there. I couldn't dream a weapon because there was no one to hold my hand. Ronan Lynch here can do anything I could do, and lots I can't. Just cut me loose.
Bride didn't say, what about the lace? Because he rarely mentioned the lace out loud unless he had to. He was just quiet for a very long time, and then he said, I won't drag you. But Ronan would. He snarled, get over yourself, princess.
What?
She demanded, shocked. Just say you want to do something easier, if that's what you mean, but don't play the boo-hoo card. Oh, me. My whole family got shot. I'm not going to cope. Please beg me to stay and make me feel good.
Hennessy twisted as much as she dared to stare at him.
You're a real piece of work.
Ronan smiled meanly at her. Somehow he just jumped straight to nastiness, but it was too late to rein it back now. I saved your life. You owe me.
I saved yours. That's what we call even.
You want to give Jordan a call and let her know you gave up then? He couldn't stop. Acid kept pouring out of him. You're setting a timer again. Life in 20-minute chunks of sleep denial, whatever. Sleep deprivation again? Hey, Jordan, they died for nothing. Can I crash with you? Thanks.
Her expression didn't change, but he watched her swallow, the tattooed roses at her throat shimmering ever so slightly with the movement.
And when I bring out all the lace and blow up the world, Bride said, we won't let that happen.
Ah, but you did, bro. Only reason why there wasn't more lace was 'cause there wasn't enough lay for it, was there? I actually got the lace out and got our boy here closer to dead at the same time. I multitasked like a mother. She was going to leave them. Ronan could tell she was. He could see every bit of her was ready to give up. Could they do it without her? Maybe, probably, but somehow the idea of saving ley lines with just Bride was awful to imagine. Awful like a thunderstorm. Awful. Awful. Ronan couldn't think about it too hard because it made him feel like flinging himself from the hoverboard just to see what would happen. What was real? Falling? Dying? Flying? They were floating 1,000 feet above the ground. Real? In a dream, there would be no consequence. Ronan was just as frightened to feel this impulse in himself as he was by the idea of saving the ley lines with just Bride. Why do you even care? Hennessy asked. The truth, not more shithead talk. He could feel the impulse to pour more acid, but he held it back. He watched his raven circle far below them, in and out of the clouds. His voice, when he spoke, was barely audible against the wind. I don't know. I just do. It wasn't a very good answer, but it was the truth. Hennessy said, Fine. Whatever. But don't say I didn't tell you. Ronan's heart was beating hard again. It was like the rush he got when the masks came out, when he knew they were going to dream. Only it was so much bigger than that. They were going to change the world. They were going to change their worlds. There was no going back. Was he doing this? He must be. What had he been made for, if not for this? Bride said, Then we begin where I left off. 18. Jordan couldn't really fathom what it was to be great at art. Other people told her she was great at art all the time. They gasped over how quickly she could pencil a likeness, the ease with which she mixed pigments, the confidence of her brushstrokes. And it wasn't that she didn't understand why they said it. The canvases she turned out were impressive. Her grasp of technique was notable at her age. Her ability to paint what she saw before her at speed was unusual. But she was simply aping other people's greatness. It wasn't that she was incapable of greatness. It was possible, probable. She had the aptitude for it. She had a very good grasp of art theory. She knew how to lead the viewer's eye around a canvas in just the order she intended. She knew how to subtract and add elements to make the eye linger or flit. She knew which colors warmed a subject closer and which cooled objects into the background. She knew how light glowed on glass, on metal, on grass, on cloth. She knew which of her paints were lean and which were fat. She knew how much turpentine to add to get the stroke she wanted. She knew what value problems varnish would and wouldn't fix. She knew all the fiddly math and science that made art and emotion work on a good canvas. Jordan had the prerequisites to be a great artist. But she was not a great artist. She was a great technician. Being in the presence of paintings like El Jaleo and Jordan in White only drove this home. They weren't great because they were technically perfect. There was something else, something more. Whether that something could be named sweet metal, she wasn't sure. What she was sure of was that pieces like that all had a way of seeing the world that no one else had noticed before. That was greatness. Jordan knew this with every fiber of her being. Every time she forged an Edward Lear, a Henry Osawa Tanner, a Frederick Remington, a George O'Keefe, a Homer, she knew. She wore their great hats for a little bit each time she forged them, but that didn't make her great. The gap between what she did and what those artists did was vast. Before Ronan, she had thought that was how it would remain. She'd figured that she would run out of time long before she'd ever have a chance to see what she was capable of. But now, she was in Boston, and her heart was still beating, and her eyes were still open. With a sweet metal in hand, she might have more time than she ever hoped for. Jordan wasn't great at art, but for the first time, she thought she might get the chance to find out if she could be.
"Thanks for the help," Jordan said.
"Sure thing," Matthew Lynch replied. "Thanks for buying my corn dog."
"Is that what you were eating? I thought it was a sock."
Matthew rubbed his stomach enthusiastically with one hand and shifted the enormous garment bag on his shoulder with the other. "Everyone needs more socks. That's what Declo says."
The advantages of bringing the youngest Lynch as her assistant were threefold. First of all, she could use an extra set of hands. Not only was it nice to have someone else to move lighting or adjust hair, but clients also paid more for artists who brought assistants. It seemed like it should be more expensive, and so it was, one of those psychological self-fulfilling prophecies. Secondly, Declan Lynch had asked if she could keep an eye on Matthew while he ran some errands, presumably of dubious legality or safety, and it was nice to be able to do him a favor to show she appreciated him coming up to Boston. And finally, it hadn't taken long for Jordan to figure out that Matthew Lynch was a little bit like a sweet metal, but for humans. People loved him. They didn't know why they loved him, but they did. Thoroughly, simply, unabashedly. That seemed like a lucky thing to have on a job.
"You're going to tell me what I need to do, right?" Matthew asked. "When we're in there?"
"That's the plan," Jordan said. "Should be nice and relaxed.
We want them to feel they've had a good time. You make them happy, they tell their friends about you. And people in places like this have friends."
"With dollar bill signs for eyes?" Matthew asked. "Wait, no. You'd be the one with the dollar bill signs, because you're the one getting paid. Or pound notes? Pound note signs?" He continued prattling on to himself as Jordan texted the client to let her know she was on the doorstep. It was an impressive doorstep. A stone-clad threshold double their height. The grand old stone Boston church had been converted to four massive luxury condos, each as large as most suburban mansions. Tastefully expensive cars sat on the curb. A nanny shot them wary looks as she pushed a stroller down the sidewalk. Matthew waved at the little girl following the nanny. The little girl waved back. There was a little hum of an electric door lock, and then the door came open. The woman in the doorway matched the cars on the sidewalk, tastefully expensive. Her smile was free for all, though.
"Hi, I'm Sherry. Jordan Hennessy?"
Jordan grinned back. "And my assistant, Matthew. This is a great location."
"We love it," said Sherry. "Still smells like contrition. Come on in."
They came on in. Jordan was combining business and pleasure, or at least business and personal. As far as Sherry knew, Jordan was just there to get reference photos for a gimmick commission. But Jordan had also discovered that Sherry and her husband, Donald, had probably purchased a sweet metal through one of Boudica's auctions years before. Probably, because Jordan wasn't 100% sure the collection it came from was made up of sweet metals. All she knew was that it had been a similarly eclectic assemblage of works that went for unexpected prices, and that it was very, very secret. More secret than one would expect a collection that included bed frames, lamps, and fine art photography to be. It had taken a lot of legwork and social pull to get even that much information. It felt like a lot of hours invested for the possibility of looking at maybe another sweet metal to see what it had in common with El Haleo and the other sweet metals she'd seen. This one was a photograph, so that was unique at least. And what other leads did she have, anyway? Inside,
The condo was modern and spare, taking advantage of the church's soaring ceilings to incorporate sleek, tall sculpture and dripping, laser-clean lighting. Not Jordan's style, but she could appreciate it. Declan would probably have been wild for it. It was a grown-up, very expensive, very specific version of his blank townhome, combined with the abstract art he'd hidden away in his attic. "I know this is kind of corny," Sherry said, "this whole thing, but I've just loved the idea of it ever since I was a kid, and I got too old to be in it myself, and now that Harlow's just big enough to be painted, I thought, I'm going to do it. I'm going to pull the trigger before I change my mind, or Donald talks me out of it."
"There's a long tradition of it," Jordan said, "so you're in good company. John White Alexander isn't what I would have imagined you'd want, though. Not with your style."
Sherry looked around the room. "Oh, this is Donald's style. I've got to do the library and bedroom. He got the living room and the dining area. We divided the territories in the peace accord."
"Oh, I see," Jordan said as Sherry led the kids into a library. It was far more what she would have expected for a client requesting John White Alexander, a traditional and mannered contemporary of John Singer Sargent. There were dark floor-to-ceiling bookcases and an ornate hulking desk holding up a Tiffany lamp. Fiddly bronzes were tucked into alcoves. The rug was a hand-knotted number so shabby that it must have cost a fortune. There was a gap in the shelves, just the right size for a Jordan Hennessy take on John Alexander White.
"This is very handsome," Jordan said.
"Thank you," Sherry replied, but she was examining her phone with annoyance.
"I'm sorry to spend your time like this, but it looks like the nanny's not checking her phone. She wasn't even supposed to be here today, but there was a mix-up, so I told her to stay on, and of course she took the kids out on a walk. I'm going to have to go catch up with her before she takes them to the aquarium or something. Do you have a minute? Help yourself to coffee. I just put a pot on. Follow your nose. The kitchen's just over there."
Once they were alone, they immediately went to get coffee. The kitchen was beautiful and unused except for the gadgets on the counter: coffee machine, blender, bread maker.
"This coffee is hairy," Matthew complained.
"It's fancy," Jordan said.
"Everything's fancy here."
"What's that lady mean about her painting? Why does she think the painting's bad before it already started?"
"Oh, 'cause it's not an original," Jordan explained, opening and closing every drawer and cabinet in the room.
"Because she doesn't want me, you see. She wants John White Alexander, but he's very dead, which isn't good for business. So she's got me, and she wants me to put her little daughter in one of his paintings."
Sherry had hired Jordan through fairly ordinary word of mouth to do one of her least sexy but most common forgeries. Historical pieces redone with the faces replaced with clients. Sherry's was at least a tasteful request. Her young daughter, done in the same style as Alexander's elegant Repose or Alethea. Two pieces subtle enough to look like homages rather than out-and-out gimmicks. Jordan tried to avoid painting clients into the birth of Venus these days.
"Like Photoshop," Matthew said. "Oh, gosh. Oh, no, that sounded mean. I didn't..."
She laughed. Matthew couldn't sound mean if he tried.
"You're not far off. It's not a direct copy. That's why I'm more swish than the other people doing it. I'm supposed to do the painting Alexander would have done if he'd been around, not just a photocopy. His palette, brushstrokes, composition. My brain, her daughter. New painting."
"Sounds hard."
"It's not. Well, not anymore. It's just my job."
Swallowing the rest of the fancy coffee, she pushed off the pure white counter to gaze at the living room walls. No photographs. She wondered if the sweet metal was even in the house. She couldn't feel anything. It wasn't like El Jaleo, where part of her could always tell it was around the corner even before she saw it. Barbara or Fisher had said something about sweet metals wearing off. Maybe it had worn out.
It's a cool job. He was glancing at her when he thought she wasn't looking. Probably he thought he was being discreet, but he wasn't. His face was curious.
Cooler than Declan's other friends.
He has friends? Jordan asked, mouth amused. She doubted this highly. Friends required honesty, which wasn't a thing Declan had a lot of. What do they do?
Number jobs? Politics? They wear ties. They have these things.
He made a gesture to his face that managed to convey facial hair. Declan stuff.
Jordan was surprised to see that Matthew seemed to believe in the neutral, boring person Declan presented to the rest of the world.
That meant Declan had played that role, even at home.
Do you go to school, Matthew?
His golden, carefree expression went troubled, and then it went blank.
This was a very different expression than the one he'd had before. Something had happened at school, she thought, or something. Oh, no. Something was wrong.
Her mind was slipping out one of the high church windows up into the sky.
She could see clouds, wings, birds, branches. Jordan dragged herself back to the present.
It had been a little bit since she'd had one of her dreamy episodes.
Never mind, she thought.
It was minor. She could push through it. She had done it before. She could do it again. It was only when they got really bad that other people began to notice she was struggling.
Oof. There it came in a wave again. Flashes of images moved before her eyes.
Images from another time, another place.
Real? Unreal? Past, future, she didn't know. It was hard to make sense of them and harder still to remind herself to make sense of them.
It only took a glance to see that Matthew was experiencing it too. He put down his coffee and was walking very, very slowly toward the door, shaking his head a little.
What a pair! Both of them were failing badly. Sherry was going to return with her daughter and find them drunkenly draped across her furniture, completely out of their heads. It would be a bad situation with any client, but it seemed worse if it was a client that had even a passing knowledge of sweet metals and the people who needed them.
Wait a tick, Jordan thought. The sweet metal. Of course.
She pushed out of a chair. When had she gotten into a chair? And tried to have a listen.
A feel. A sense. If there was a sweet metal in this house, it would give them back their thoughts until the ley line got itself back together, hopefully.
She caught a whiff, she thought. Come on, she told Matthew, grabbing his arm to tug him deeper into the condo. Focus, if you can. Come on.
Together, they investigated the condo as quickly and quietly as they could. Here was the library again. They'd gotten turned around. Here a nursery, a bathroom, a closet, a study,
mirrors, art, books. It was hard to remember what they'd already seen.
Hard to remember what they were looking at, even as they were looking at it.
Oh, thank God. There it was.
She felt the sweet metal as soon as she passed the doorway.
Stepping inside the room was like stepping into reality itself.
It was an enormous master suite, and the sweet metal, wherever it was in the room, worked well enough to provide dramatic clarity. It made every detail sharp. Every stitch on the duvet, every curl in the carved posters of the bed, every velvet ripple of the curtain.
Both Jordan and Matthew heaved huge sighs of relief as they collapsed on either end of a fainting couch in the master sitting area.
Slowly, the two of them rebooted.
She could see this slow motion return to herself reflected on Declan's little brother's face. That confusion turning to relief, turning to frustration, and then finally turning to normality. It reminded her, sadly, of the girls. They had all done this together, too, when Hennessy waited too long to dream or when the ley line sagged.
Which was happening now?
It was hard to say. Hennessy hadn't managed to get in touch with Jordan yet.
I didn't know that's what was happening to me, Matthew said, before I found out. I didn't know it was because I was a dream. I've never seen anything else do it before. Anything human, I mean. Oh, I didn't mean to be mean. I didn't... I know what you meant. Not one of Ronan's things. A person. I never saw an animal do it before his bird either, so we're the same, you and I. Matthew just kept frowning at the floor, chewing on his lip pensively, so she stood up and snooped around the room until she found the sweet metal. It had been pushed under the bed, probably because it didn't match anything else in this room. It was a black and white photograph of a diner with a skinny man in spats standing in front of it, looking at something outside the frame. She could feel that it was a sweet metal, but she couldn't tell why. It was like the landscape at the Boudicca party. She hadn't been able to tell why she liked that one, and she couldn't tell why she liked this one either. She pushed it back under the bed where she'd found it. I think Ronan dreamed me to be stupid, Matthew said. I think I'm stupider than most people. I don't think very hard. I don't think. You seem normal to me. You knew to look for that thing under the bed. I was just walking around in circles. Maybe I'm just very clever. Dreamed to be clever? Clever because Hennessy's clever and because I take a daily vitamin. Whatever, Matthew sounded disappointed. I don't think your brother dreamt himself an idiot brother, she said. But somehow this made her think about how she was missing the memories of Jay. She'd always thought of herself as identical to Hennessy, apart from the dreaming. But it was obvious that she wasn't. She didn't think Ronan had dreamt his brother to be an idiot, but perhaps he had dreamt him to be lovable. Perhaps Hennessy had dreamt Jordan without those memories on purpose. Oh, there you are, Sherry said. She held the hand of the little girl Matthew had waved at earlier. The suspicious nanny stood in the hallway behind her, holding the baby from the stroller. Sorry to wander, Jordan said. I had to pee, Matthew said with a little laugh, and because he was Matthew, Sherry laughed with him. Jordan didn't think he was as guileless as he feared. It was a solid deception. And while looking for the bathroom, I saw this couch, Jordan said, gesturing to the chaise Matthew was on. And I just think it's even more what we're looking for. The lighting through this window will do so much work for us. You have a great eye. Sherry lit up. I bought that couch last year. I thought it was special. I'm so glad. They'd gotten away with it. Jordan and Matthew busied themselves. Matthew retrieved the garment bag from the other room and made such a noise of surprise at the massive period dresses inside when he opened it that Sherry and her daughter both laughed at him. Jordan posed the daughter and began to take reference shots, and as she did, Matthew told Sherry jokes. Eventually, Matthew got Sherry so cheery that Jordan persuaded her to try on the other period dress and posed her together with her daughter on the chaise. The single portrait became a double, which increased the price by a third and also made it more interesting by far. She and Matthew were actually a pretty good team, she thought, as they accepted the deposit from Sherry and retreated from the church. On the sidewalk, Jordan folded over some of the bills to Matthew. Is this pity money? Matthew said suspiciously. What does that mean? I don't know. To make me feel like I was grown up. You did a job. I'm paying you for the job. Don't get a complex. I know that's what Lynch brothers seem to do, but try to avoid it. He sighed. Thanks, then. For back there, too. The dreaminess. She'd forgotten how bad the episodes could be, how quickly they could come on. She'd forgotten how she'd been in the middle of one when Declan realized she was a dream. She'd forgotten why she'd understood why it would drive him away. No one wanted to be the only man left awake. Ordinarily, a dreamy episode would have defeated Jordan's mood for the rest of the day, but she found her mood was still as light as it had been before. This was why she was here in Boston.
This was why she was searching underneath the beds of strangers. This was why she had bought yet another ticket to the gardener. She was finding a sweet metal. She was getting a sweet metal. She was staying awake. She was staying awake long enough to become great.
19. Ronan Lynch still remembered the best dream he'd ever had. It was an old dream now, 2 years old, maybe a little less. In the divide of before his father's death and after, it was after. It was also after his mother's death. It was before Harvard, before Bride. By the time this one showed up, Ronan had a pretty long list of good dreams. Most of them were from before, and most of them, like many good dreams, were wish fulfillment. They were the usual valuable possession dreams, opening a bedroom door to discover that the mattress had been replaced by a very expensive trendy sound system. There were dreams of impossible abilities, flying, speeding, long jumps, 1-2 punches that knocked intruders clear into next year. Sex dreams ranked well, depending on the players involved. They could just as easily slide into nightmare territory. Places of unreal beauty often made the list. Rocky green islands, clear blue lakes, flower-busy fields. And of course, there were the ones where he had his family back. What would you do if you accidentally brought your mother back? Adam had asked one evening before he'd left for Harvard. If you woke up with another Aurora, would you keep her? I'm not in the mood for word problems, Ronan had replied. You've thought about it, surely. Of course he had. The ethics of replacing his father were clear enough. Copying a real person was no bueno. But Aurora had already been a dream, which made the waters murkier. He wouldn't have been content with a dreamt copy, but Matthew might be. Could he end Matthew's grieving with another mother? Spare Declan the effort of raising Matthew by providing another mother? Did it do a disservice to his real mother's memory, even if she was already a dream? What if he did it wrong? What if he brought back a copy identical except for one fatal flaw? An Aurora with a disinterest in loving Matthew. An Aurora who didn't age. An Aurora who aged too fast. An Aurora with a desire to eat human flesh. What then? What then? I hadn't, Ronan lied. He didn't lie, especially to Adam, but he wanted the conversation to be over. What if you brought another me back? What would you do with the extra Adam? Adam asked, curious, unbothered. He wasn't squeamish, and in any case, it was just a thought exercise to him. His dreams weren't going to cough up another Ronan. But Ronan's dreams might. He'd lost sleep over this question, wondering if he truly had it in him to kill an unwanted, dreamt human. He'd learned to kill in his dreams, of course. The second he realized he didn't have enough control to prevent unwanted manifestation, he took down everyone in sight, and he'd accordingly woken with a share of corpses. But killing a dream after he'd woken? Killing them once they were real? It felt like a dangerous line to cross. It's not going to happen, Ronan said, so it doesn't matter. I think you ought to assume it's going to happen at some point and make a plan, Adam said.
It's not going to happen, Ronan repeated. But the threat had lodged inside him, and now dreams had to be unpopulated to land on the very good dream list. He could risk no more Matthews, no Auroras, not even any little Opals, who was slightly more creature than human. It was too weighty. So, the best dream. This was what happened in the best dream. Rona was in a car. It was a beautiful car, beautiful in appearance. Long, gleaming hood, glistening black wheels, glaring headlights with teeth-bared matte grille, and also in sound, engine heaving with power, exhaust growling with urgency. Every detail Ronan could see was art. Metal and wood, bone and vines. It was one of those dream objects that didn't entirely make sense according to waking world rules. The car was already in motion when the dream began.
Ronan was driving it. He could see himself in the rearview mirror. He was older, this Ronan in the mirror. His jaw was more squared and stubbled. He wore something leather and cool. He didn't know where he was coming from. The dream wasn't interested in that. The dream was interested in where the car was going, and this was where the car was going, through a chain-link fence, across cardboard boxes and plastic containers and toys, over another little car in the middle of the asphalt, tires disintegrating the other car's rear window as it went. It drove through a sign for a mattress store, flattened an inflatable snowman in front of another store, clipped a billboard, sending it all crashing down behind it. It took out bus stops and traffic lights, road signs and mailboxes. There were no people in this dream, so there was no screaming, no one to hurt, no one to bring back by accident. There was just a howl of the engine, the thump of the bumper, the grinding apocalypse beneath the tires. Music thumped from the car's beautiful carved speakers. The whole dream could hear it. And finally, Ronan found himself speeding directly toward an identical car with an identical Ronan in it. It took him a moment to realize it wasn't actually another car. It was the mirrored front of a club. The music from inside drowned out every other sound. It was the sort of music Ronan heard all the time when he was at Aglenby, the stuff that made him feel as if he truly were nothing like other people, not because he was gay or because his father had been murdered or because he could take things out of his dreams, but because he couldn't bring himself to sing along to the shit other students sang along to. Funny how a handful of people loving a song you couldn't stand could make you feel inhuman. In this dream, the best dream, Ronan and the dreamt car smashed right through the club's window. There were no dancers, just pounding music, strobe lights, glitter, and 10,000 alcoholic beverages on the floor where there should have been people. Ronan began to do donuts. The tires squealed, drinks flew, speakers topped, plastic splintered, metal twisted, glass shivered. Destruction drowned out both the club's music and Ronan's, and it was gorgeous. Then Ronan woke up, heart pounding, hands still clenched in fists, ears ringing with remembered sound, paralyzed. What had he brought back? Only the dream's furious joy. That was the best dream. The first thing the dreamers destroyed with Bride was an exit ramp. The battle was undramatic, uncontested. Once upon a time, there was an exit ramp cut deeply into a mountain by bulldozers, a clover leaf of asphalt imposed upon the wild. And then once upon a little later time, the exit ramp didn't exist anymore. It was just a pile of rubble that returned the hillside to its natural form, the work of a transient storm dreamt to thrash just beneath the soil. Why did it even need to be there, a new highway, a new clover leaf in the middle of nowhere? Because it could be. Next, there was the dump. Trash piled upon trash. Old groceries rotting, new appliances rusting, plastic bottles bleeding out the remainder of their contents. Ronan had never seen a dump so big. Hadn't believed such dumps existed in the United States. He hadn't imagined there was so much trash in the country, much less in a single dump. It took all night even for a dreamt blue fire to burn it all. And when the fire took the support buildings and the road leading to the dump too, the dreamers didn't stop it. It was only when the otherworldly flames began to creep toward the trailer park below that Bride spat scornfully and signaled for Ronan to smother it with a quickly dreamt dissolving blanket. The next to go was a brand new shopping area, which was identical to the shopping area just a few miles away. Which was identical to the shopping area just a few miles away. Which was identical to the shopping area just a few miles away. Which was identical to the shopping area just a few miles away. Which was identical to the shopping area just a few miles away. The dreamers arrived and they put on their masks, and less than an hour later it was all gone. Dug up, dug under. A dreamt dirt dragon charged from the ground to destroy and then dissolve just as quickly when the chaos was through. After that, the dreamers destroyed an underwater transmission line, a 230 kV line that had once connected generators on opposite sides of a riverbank and also completely disordered the local ley line. As night fell,
A school, a swarm, a hurricane of pitch-black dolphins had snaked toward the line. They were difficult to see in the water, since they reflected light in nearly the same way as the river water all around them. They were, after all, made almost entirely of dark ice. They were melting even as they swam toward their dreamt purpose, but not fast enough to ruin their mission, only enough to chill the river as they dug through the silt and sediment down to the transmission line, only enough that they could no longer swim at speed as they parted their bottle noses to reveal shining, hungry teeth, only enough that by the time they had chewed through the work that had taken many months, there was nothing left to see of the dolphins but a few melting hearts at the bottom of the river. The dreamers traveled hundreds of miles each day to put distance between themselves and their latest crime. Over and over they drove to a destination, planned how best to destroy it, dreamt the tool of destruction, unleashed it, and then lingered long enough to make sure they'd left no trace of their dreaming behind. They disrupted a convoy of trucks carrying transformers. They aerosolized 2 acres of unused concrete parking lot outside a dying mall. They filled canals and emptied swimming pools. Everywhere they went looked different when they were gone, or rather, it looked less different, more like it had before humans arrived. When they dreamt, Hronan dreamt of Illidorin. He dreamt of the stump, and he dreamt of a slowly uncurling green shoot growing from its interior. It was getting stronger. Hronan was getting stronger, too. "What do you feel?" Bride asked. They sat on the roofline of an abandoned Victorian, looking out over the battered town around it. It was just at sunset, and there was barely enough light to see shapes by natural light. The dreamers would have been visible on their perch if anyone had looked up, but no one in this town had looked up for decades. "Ronan," prompted Bride, "what do you feel?" Ronan didn't answer. It was the kind of night that made him want to run and run and run until he couldn't catch his breath, but that wasn't the kind of feeling Bride meant. "I feel like I can still smell that mill," Hennessy said. "I will smell like it for the rest of my life." The dreamers had just destroyed a pulp mill on the other side of town. It had been one of the worst smells Ronan had ever smelled, and that included the odors at the West Virginia Museum of Living History, the trash dump they destroyed, and the bodies he'd buried over the years. He wondered how long it would take people to notice it was gone. The mill. The smell. All of it. Would they notice the silhouette was missing from the horizon before the sun went down? Perhaps tomorrow when they arrived to work only to discover the mill had been replaced with a meadow. Unless tomorrow was a weekend. Ronan had no idea what day of the week it was. Time worked differently now. Weekends felt like a concept that had been important before. "What do you feel?" Bride persisted. "Nothing." "This dinosaur," Ronan said, running his fingers over Chainsaw's nubbly talons. The raven clutched the peak of the roof beside him and peered off at the disappearing sun, beak parted, as if imagining how good it would have tasted. "And the spine of this roof up my..." Hennessy gasped. Bride just had time to grab her arm before she tumbled from the roof. Her fingers clung to him as he dragged her back up. Ronan didn't have time to ask what had happened. It hit him next. Suddenly, he was electric. He was free, his thoughts flying into the air. He was trapped, his body fused to something deep in the earth. He was both these things at once. He felt as if he could do anything, anything he had ever possibly wanted to do. Anything except untangle himself from that thing he was wound around. This thing, this entity, this energy, this whatever it was making him so powerful, so alive. He understood it. He heard it. He was it. "God damn," he whispered. Bride smiled. It was an altogether different smile than Ronan had ever seen him wear, his light teeth visible in the deepening dark, his eyes half closed, his head thrown back. Euphoric. Relieved.
That's the ley line, Bride said. Ronan felt it uncurl through him, like vines stretching toward the sun. It was the humming possibility of his dreams, the sense of ever-widening options, but he was awake. With a glorious cry, Chainsaw threw herself from the roof and soared high up into the air. Part of him felt like he might be able to join her.
Why is it doing that?
Hennessy asked in a small voice. Bride was still holding her steady on the roof, a hand gripped very firmly around her upper arm.
It's a surge, he said. It won't last. If we are lucky, we will feel another, perhaps a third, the heartbeat of a sick planet coming round.
Nightwash felt a million miles away, like something that could never touch Ronan. He was the night, and he was the world, and he was as infinite as them both. Chainsaw cawed up above, and Ronan spontaneously leapt to his feet, keeping his balance easily on the ridge of the roof. He cawed back to his dreamt raven at the top of his lungs. The sound echoed all around the roofs of this dead town, making it sound like there was a whole flock of ravens, a whole flock of Ronans, even though there was just a pair of them.
It's so strong, Hennessy said, even though it was already beginning to wane.
The world was changing. It was becoming a place someone like him had been made for. Bride said, "This is only the beginning."
20. Carmen Farouk Lane hadn't told Locke about Jordan Hennessy's sword.